Versailles. Raymond tells us about the artwork, names I know he has learned only from magazines. Stella, Johns, Rauschenberg. "I especially like this piece," he says. Squiggles and squares. In a conference room, there is a 30-foot table milled from a single piece of green malachite. Sandy asks about Raymond's practice. Mostly federal work so far, Raymond says, which he thinks is a good thing. He has a grand jury going great guns in Cleveland. His client sold parachutes to the Defense Department. They contain defective rope. A purely inadvertent oversight, Raymond tells us, with a knavish smile. 110,000 pieces. Finally, we arrive at Raymond's office. They have given him a corner, and he has the fancy views, west and south. The wall of respect has been reinstalled here with a few additions. A panoramic shot of the dais at Raymond's last inauguration is at the center now. With 40 others, I am there, way off on the right. I had not noticed a young man until Raymond introduces him. Peter something, an associate. Peter has a pad and pen. Peter is the prover. He will cover Raymond in the event there is later controversy about what he said. "So what can I do for you?" Raymond asks after he is called out for coffee. "First," says Sandy, "Rusty and I both want to thank you for taking the time to meet. You are very gracious." Raymond waves this off. "What can I say?" A non sequitur of sorts. I think he means to suggest he wants to help without saying that. "I think it best, I'm sure you understand," says Stern, "that Rusty not take part in our conversation. I hope you do not mind if he simply listens." As he says this, Sandy glances toward Peter, who has raised his pad and is already relentlessly making notes. "Sure, it's your ball game." Raymond starts fussing on his desk, brushing at dust neither I nor he can see. "I'm surprised you wanted him to come, but that's up to you guys." Sandy flexes his brow characteristically, one of those Latin gestures reflecting something too delicate or imprecise to say. "So, what do you want me to tell you?" Raymond again asks. "We find your name on Delaguardia's witness list. That, of course, motivates our visit." "Sure," says Raymond and throws up his hands. "You know how it is, Alejandro. The guy sends you a party invitation, you gotta go to the ball." I have seen this bluff, hearty manner from Raymond 1,000 times before. He gestures too much. His broad features are always tending toward a smile. His eyes seldom meet those of the person to whom he is speaking. This was how he negotiated with defense lawyers. "I'm a great guy, but I just can't help." When his visitors left, Raymond would often call them names.
"So you will be appearing by subpoena?"
"You bet."
"I see. We receive no statement. Do I take it that you have not spoken to the prosecutors?"
"No, I talked to them a little bit. You know, I talked to you, I talked to them. We had some troubles at first. Mike Duke had to work some things out. I've sat down with Tom Molto a few times now. Shit, more than a few times. But, you know, it's one-on-one. I haven't signed a statement or anything like that."
A bad sign. Very bad.
Panic and anger both are rising in me, but I try to stave them off. Raymond is getting star witness treatment. No formal statements to minimize the inconsistencies that would endanger him on cross-examination. Multiple sessions with the prosecutor because he is so important to the case.
"You mention troubles," says Sandy. "There is no question of immunity, I take it?"
"Shit, no. Nothing like that. It's just that some of these guys around here, my new partners, this whole thing makes them nervous. It could be a little embarrassing for me, too." He laughs. "That's a hell of a way to start out. I'm here 3 days, and I get a grand jury subpoena. I bet Solly Weiss loved that," he says, referring to the firm's managing partner. Sandy is silent. He has his hat and briefcase positioned decorously in the center of his lap. He studies Horgan without apology, searching him. The man is volunteering nothing. Stern becomes like this at moments, suddenly abandons all his comfortable civility and seems to sink beneath the surface of things.
"And what have you told them?" Sandy finally asks quietly. He is very still. My partners?
Certainly not.
I was wondering what we might expect in terms of your testimony. You have been on this side of things before. Sandy subsides into his more familiar tone, gentle and indirect. When he asked what Raymond told them a second ago, it was like a flash of light suddenly reflected. His mettle was at once obvious and fully summoned.
Well, you know, I don't want to get into a word for word.
He nods in the direction of the young man taking notes.
Of course not, Sandy says. Topics, areas, whatever you feel you can comfortably tell.
It is very difficult from the outside even to guess sometimes what a witness might be called to discuss.
You know this yourself so well.
Sandy is probing for something that I do not completely understand. We could get up now and leave if we were merely here to accomplish the previously announced purpose of our visit. We know where Raymond Horgan stands. He is not a friend.
I'm going to testify about Rusty's conduct of the investigation, how he told me he'd be interested in handling it, and a later conversation we had about aspects of my personal life.
Just a second, I can take no more. How I was interested in handling the investigation? Raymond, you asked me to take the case.
There was a conversation between us.
From the corner of my eye, I note Stern raising a hand, but I fix on Horgan. Raymond, you asked me. You told me that you were busy with the campaign. It had to be in the best hands. You couldn't worry about somebody else lousing this up.
That's possible. That's what happened.
I look to Stern, seeking support. He is sitting back in his chair, staring at me. He is simply furious. I'm sorry, I say quietly. Raymond goes on, oblivious to my exchange with my lawyer.
I don't remember that, Rusty. Maybe that's what happened. As you said, I was busy with a campaign. But the way I remember it, we had a conversation, a day, 2 days before the funeral, and at the end of that conversation, we had agreed that you'd be handling the case, and the idea that you'd handle it, it's my feeling that it was more your idea than mine. I was receptive, I admit that, but I remember some surprise about the way things ended up.
Raymond. What are you trying to do to me, Raymond? I look at Sandy, who has his eyes closed. Can't I just ask him that? But I have finally pushed things beyond the crest. Raymond is traveling full speed downhill on his own momentum. He leans as far as he can across his desk.
What am I trying to do to you?
He repeats the question twice, growing flushed.
What were you trying to do to me, Rusty? What the hell are your fingerprints doing all over that goddamn glass? What's all this bullshit of sitting in my office asking about who I'm fucking, and never then, when it would have been friendly, or 2 weeks before, when I assigned you to that investigation, which, as I remember, I bawled you out a couple of times for not pushing?
He turns abruptly to Sandy and points.
That's something else I'm going to testify to, he tells Sandy, then looks back at me. Never, 2 weeks before, when it was the professional thing to have done, never, at any time, do you tell me you were dicking the same gal. I've spent a whole long time on that conversation, Rusty, asking myself what the hell you were doing there. What were you doing?
This scene is more than Peter the associate can handle. He has stopped writing entirely and is just watching us. Stern points at Peter.
Under the circumstances, I am advising my client to make no response. Clearly, he would like to.
So that's what I'm going to testify to, Raymond tells Sandy.
He stands up and ticks the points off on his fingers.
That he wanted the case, that I had to chew his ass repeatedly to move it, that he was more interested in finding out who else was fucking Carolyn than who had murdered her, and that when push finally came to shove, he sat in my office and gave us all a bunch of happy horseshit that he'd been nowhere near Carolyn's apartment that night. That's what I'll testify to, and I'll be goddamn pleased to do it.
Very well, Raymond, says Sandy.
He picks up his hat, a gray felt Homburg, off the chair on which he had laid it in the midst of his efforts to quiet me. I stare directly at Horgan. He looks back.
Nico Della Guardia was honest about the fact that he was out to screw me, Horgan says.
Sandy steps between us. He hauls me to my feet, both hands on my arm.
Enough, he declares.
Son of a bitch,
I say as we are moving briskly ahead of Peter on our way out.
Son of a bitch. We know where we stand, Stern says quietly.
As we enter the reception area, he tells me in the barest sibilance to please hush. This enforced silence sits in my mouth like a bit. As the elevator sinks, I find myself with a bursting desperation to speak, and I grab Sandy's arm as we reach the ground floor.
What is it with him?
He is a very angry man. Stern walks determinedly through the marble lobby.
I see that. Has Nico convinced him that I'm guilty?
Probably.
Certainly he thinks you could have been a good deal more cautious, particularly on his behalf.
I wasn't a faithful servant?
Sandy makes another of his Latin movements. Hands, eyes, brow. He has other matters on his mind. As he walks, he cocks a grave eye in my direction.
I had no idea that Horgan had an affair with Carolyn,
or that you had conversed with him on that subject.
I didn't remember the conversation.
No doubt, says Stern, in a tone which implies that he doubts me a good deal.
Well, I think De La Guardia will be able to use that to his advantage.
When was it that this relationship took place between Raymond and Carolyn?
Right after she stopped seeing me. Sandy stops. He makes no effort to mask his pain. He talks to himself an instant in his native tongue.
Well, Nico is certainly coming closer to a motive.
But he's still some distance, I say hopefully. He still cannot prove the principal relationship between Carolyn and me.
Some, Sandy tells me. There is a deliberate flatness in his expression.
He is clearly quite put out with me, both for my performance upstairs and for keeping so significant a detail from him. We will have to speak at length, he says. Right now he has a court call. He puts his Hamburg on and ventures into the blazing heat without glancing back at me. In the lobby, I feel instantly bereft. So many emotions are surging that there is a kind of dizziness. Most of all, there is caustic shame for my own stupidity. After all these years, I still failed to recognize how these events would impact on Raymond Horgan, although now the trajectory of his emotions seems as predictable as a hyperbolic curve. Raymond Horgan is a public man. He has lived to make a reputation. He said he was not a Pole, but he has a Pole's affliction. He thrives on acclamation. He yearns for the good opinion of everyone. He does not care about my guilt or innocence. He is devastated by his own disgrace. His own chief deputy indicted for murder. The investigation, which he let me run, sabotaged right before his face. And he will have to sit upon the witness stand and broadcast his own indiscretions. There will be tavern jokes for years about a deputy PA under Raymond Horgan. Between his conduct and mine, the office will sound more active than a Roman bath. Worst of all is the fact that the murder took Raymond from the life he really loved. It changed the course of the election. It sent him here to his glass and steel cage. What infuriates Raymond, inspires his rage, is not really that I committed this crime. It is that he believes he was intended to be another victim. He said as much when he finally let things loose. I screwed him. I killed Carolyn to bring him down. And I succeeded. Horgan thinks he has the whole thing figured out, and he has clearly planned his vengeance. I finally leave the building. The heat is intense. The sun is blinding. I feel instantly unsteady on my feet. Compulsively, I try to calculate the 1,000 subtle impacts on the trial of Raymond's testimony and his evident hostility to me. But that soon gives way. Ideas come and go erratically. I see my father's face. I cannot make things connect. After all these weeks, after all of this, I feel that I am finally going to go to pieces. And I find, stunningly, that as I turn about in the street, I am praying. A habit of my childhood, when I would try to cover my bets with a God in whom I knew I did not much believe. And now, dear God, I think, dear God in whom I do not believe, I pray to you to stop this, for I am deathly frightened. Dear God, I smell my fear with an odor as distinct as ozone on the air after a lightning flash. I feel fear so palpably it has a color, and oozing fiery red, and I feel it pitifully in my bones, which ache. My pain is so extreme that I can barely move down this hot avenue, and for a moment cannot, as my backbone bows with fear, as if a smelted rod, red-hot and livid, had been laid there. Dear God, dear God, I am in agony and fear, and whatever I may have done to make you bring this down upon me, release me, please, I pray, release me, release me. Dear God, in whom I do not believe, dear God, let me go free.
Chapter 22.
In the United States, the prosecution in a criminal case may not appeal the outcome. This is a constitutional principle declared by the U.S. Supreme Court. An American prosecutor, alone among all the advocates who stand before the bench, among the sophisticates and hacks, the collection lawyers in their rayon suits, the bankruptcy moguls, the divorce court screamers, the gold-chained dope lawyers, or the smooth likes of Sandy Stern, the big firm litigators who perform even routine courtroom tasks in pairs, the prosecutor alone is without right to seek review of a judge's trial rulings. Whatever the majesty of his office, the power of the policeman he commands, the bias in his favor jurors always bring to court, a prosecutor is often under a continuing duty to endure in silence various forms of judicial abuse. Nowhere, while I was a PA, was that obligation more regularly or onerously borne than in the courtroom of Judge Laron Little. He is sly and learned and indisposed by the experience of a lifetime to the state's point of view. The habits of 20 years as a defense lawyer, in which he regularly manhandled and belittled prosecutors and police, have never left him on the bench. And beyond that, he has a black man's authentic education in the countless ways that prosecutorial discretion can be used to arrogantly excuse unreasoning caprice. The random and complete injustices which he witnessed on the streets have become a kind of emotional encyclopedia for him, informing each decision that is made almost reflexively against the state. After 2 or 3 years, Raymond gave up coming to court to argue. The two of them would bellow at each other, as they must have done in their old law office. Then Laron would bang his gavel, more adamant than ever, and declare a recess so that he and Raymond could make up back in chambers and plan to have a drink. Judge Little is on the bench, receiving status reports on other cases when Stern and I arrive. It is always as if there is a spotlight. He is the only person you see, handsome, mercurial, extraordinarily prepossessing. Judge Little is a big human being, 6'4" or 6'5" and broad across. His first fame came as a football and basketball hero at the U, where he went on scholarship. He has a full head of medium-length African hair, most of it gone gray, a big face, enormous hands, a princely style of oratory, with a large voice, full across all the male ranges. His intelligence, which is mighty, is also somehow transmitted by his presence. Some say Laron sees his future on the federal bench. Others guess that his real goal is to succeed Albright Williamson as the congressman from the district north of the river, whenever it is that Williamson ceases defying age and his cardiologist's predictions. Whatever his inclinations, Laron is someone whose prospects and personal powers make him, in these parts, a man of capital importance. We were summoned here yesterday morning by a phone call from the judge's docket clerk. With the filing of the defendant's pretrial motions 2 days ago, His Honor desires to hold a status hearing on my case. I suspect that he is going to rule on some of our requests and perhaps discuss a trial date. Sandy and I wait in silence. Kemp has stayed behind. The three of us spent yesterday together, and I told them everything I knew about each witness Nico has listed for the case. Stern's questions remained precise and limited. He still did not ask me if I screwed Carolyn that night, or was there for any other reason, or whether, notwithstanding my prior proclamations, I own any instrument that might conform to the crack atop her head. I spend these moments, familiar downtime in a courtroom lawyer's life, looking about. The reporters are all here again, although the sketchers have stayed home. Judge Little, politic in the ways a judge can be, treats reporters well. There is a table set aside for them against the western wall, and he always gives the press room a call before issuing any decision of import. The courtroom where the course of the rest of my life will be determined is a jewel. The jury box is set off by a walnut rail and descending baubles, round spheres of beautifully grained wood. The witness stand is similarly constructed and abuts the judge's bench, which is well elevated and covered by a walnut canopy supported by two red marble pillars. The docket clerk, the bailiff, and the court reporter, whose job is to write down every word spoken in open court, are in a well before the bench. A few feet in front of them, two tables have been placed, finely hewn, again in darker walnut, with carefully turned legs. These tables for the lawyers on trial sit perpendicular to the bench. The prosecution, by tradition, will sit nearer the jury. When all the other business is finished, our case is called. Some of the reporters creep up to the defense table to better hear the proceedings, and the assembly of lawyers, and me, convene before the bench. Stern, Molto, and Nico state their names. Sandy notes my presence. Tommy shoots me a little grin. I bet he's heard about our meeting with Raymond last week. "Gentlemen," Judge Little begins, "I asked you here because I thought we could do a little work to move this case along. I have some motions from the defendant, and I'm prepared to rule on them, unless the prosecutors are particularly anxious to make a response." Tommy speaks in Nico's ear. "Only to the motion to disqualify Mr. Molto," Nico says. "Naturally, I think. An entire office working for him, and he's still gun-shy about putting things on paper." Laren says that he will leave the motion to disqualify to the end, although he has some thoughts about it. "Now, the first motion," Laren says, with the stack of paper right before him, "is a motion to set an immediate trial date. And I've thought about this, and as the prosecutors know, the Rodriguez case pled earlier this morning, so I will be free for 12 trial days beginning 3 weeks from today." Laren looks at his calendar. "August 18. Mr. Stern, can you be here?" This is an extraordinary development. We had expected nothing sooner than the fall. Sandy will have to set everything else aside. But he barely hesitates. "With pleasure, Your Honor." "And the prosecution?" Nico at once begins to back and fill. "He has a vacation planned. So does Mr. Molto. There is still evidence to be developed." With that, Vesuvius erupts.
"No, no," says Judge Little. "I will hear none of that. No, sir, Mr. Delay Guardia."
He pronounces Nico's name that way, as if he is trying to incorporate the nickname. With Laren, you can never tell.
These charges are the most serious crime. What else could you do to Mr. Savage, a prosecutor his entire professional life, and you bring charges like this? We all know why Mr. Stern wants a quick trial. There are no secrets here. We've all been trying cases for a good part of our lives. Mr. Stern has looked at the evidence you have provided by way of discovery, Mr. Delay Guardia, and he doesn't think you have much of a case. He may not be right. I wouldn't know about that. But if you come into this courtroom charging a man with a crime, you better be ready to prove it. Right now. Don't be telling me about what's going to develop. You can't leave this hanging over Mr. Savage like that old sword of Damocles. No, sir," Laren says again. "We're going to have a trial 3 weeks from today."
My blood is ice. Without excusing myself, I take a seat at the head of the defense table. Stern glances back momentarily and seems to smile.
"Now, what else have we got?"
says Laren, just for an instant as he looks about there is a private smile. He can never quite hide his satisfaction with himself for trashing a prosecutor. He passes quickly on our motions for production. Everyone is granted, as they should be. Tommy complains a little bit about the motion to produce the glass. He reminds the court that the prosecution has the burden of proving a chain of custody, that is, that the glass was never out of the state's hands, an impossibility if the glass is turned over to the defense.
"Well, what is it that the defense wants to do with this glass?"
I stand immediately.
"I want to take a look at it, Your Honor."
Sandy gives me a corrosive glance. With his hand on my forearm, he puts me back down in my seat. I will have to learn, It is not my place to speak.
Fine, says Laren. Mr. Savage wants to look at the glass. That's all. He's got that right. The prosecution has got to show him the evidence. You know, I've looked over the discovery, and I understand why Mr. Savage might want to look very carefully at that glass, so that motion will be allowed.
Laren points at me. It is the first real notice he has taken of my presence.
And by the way now, Mr. Savage, you, of course, will be heard through counsel, but if it's your desire to speak yourself, you have that right, at any time. When we have our conferences in chambers or during the proceedings, you have every right to attend. I want you to know that. We all know Mr. Savage is a fine trial lawyer, one of the finest trial lawyers we have in these parts, and I'm sure he'll be curious about what we're doing from time to time.
I look at Sandy, who nods before I answer. I thank the court. I tell him I will listen. My lawyer will speak.
Very well, the judge says. But his eyes hold the light of a warmth that I have never seen from him in court. I am a defendant now, in his special custody. Like a chieftain or a mafia don, he owes me some protection while I am in his domain. Next, we have this motion to get into the apartment.
Molto and Nico confer.
No objection, Nico says, so long as a police officer is present. To that, Sandy instantly objects. A few moments of typical courtroom skirmishing follow. Everybody knows what's going on. The prosecutors want to figure out what we are looking for. On the other hand, they have a valid point. Any disturbance of the contents of Carolyn's apartment will hinder their ability to make further use of the scene for evidentiary purposes.
Well, you have pictures by now, Laren says.
Every time I have one of these cases, I wonder if the prosecutors haven't formed some kind of alliance with Kodak.
The reporters all laugh, and Laren himself smiles. He is like that. He loves to entertain. He directs his gavel at DeLaGuardia.
You can have a trooper by the door, so you can be sure that no members of the defense remove anything. But I'm not going to let you snoop on what they're looking at. The prosecution's had 4 months to look all over that apartment,
Laren says, including in his count the month when I was head of the investigative team.
I think the defense is entitled to a few minutes in peace. Mr. Stern, you draft an appropriate order and I'll sign it. And let's be sure that you give notice in advance to Ms. Polhemus's administrator or executor or whoever represents her estate, so they know what the court intends to allow. Now, let's talk about this motion to disqualify Mr. Molto.
This is our request to prevent Tommy Molto from acting as one of the trial lawyers on the case, because Nico has said Molto may be a witness. Nico starts right in. To disqualify one of the prosecutors with 3 weeks to trial would be an onerous burden. Impossible. The state could never be ready. I do not know if Nico is looking for more time or trying to defeat the motion. He's probably not sure himself.
Well, look now, Mr. DeLaGuardia. I'm not the person who told you to put Mr. Molto on your witness list, Judge Little says. I cannot imagine how you thought you were going to proceed with a prosecutor who might be a witness. A lawyer may not be an advocate and a witness in the same proceeding. We've been doing business in our courts the same way for about 400 years now, and I do not intend to change it for this trial, no matter how important it is to any of the participants, no matter how many reporters show up from Time or Newsweek or anyplace else.
Judge Little pauses and squints toward the reporters' gallery, as if he only now had noticed them there.
But let me say this.
Laren stands up and wanders behind the bench. 5 feet off the ground to start with, he speaks from an enormous height.
Now I take it, Mr. DeLaGuardia, that the statement you are speaking of is the one where Mr. Savage responds to Mr. Molto's accusation of murder by saying, "You're right."
Yeah, you're right, says Nico.
Laren accepts the correction, bowing his large head.
All right. Now, the state has not offered the statement yet. However, you've indicated your intentions, and Mr. Stern has made his motion for that reason. But this is what occurs to me. I really am not sure that statement will come into evidence. Mr. Stern hasn't made any objection yet. He would rather see Mr. Molto disqualified first. But I imagine, Mr. DeLaGuardia, that when we get there, Mr. Stern is going to say that this statement is not relevant.
This is one of Laren's favorite means of assisting the defense. He predicts objections he is likely to hear. Some of them, like this one, are clearly going to come. Others never would have occurred to defense counsel. In either event, when formally made, the objections foretold inevitably succeed.
Your Honor, says Nico, the man admitted the crime.
Oh, Mr. Delay Guardia, says Judge Little, really? You see, that is my point. You tell a man he's engaged in wrongdoing, and he says, yeah, you're right. Everyone recognizes that's facetious. We all are familiar with that. Now, in my neighborhood, had Mr. Savage come from those parts, he would have said, yo mama.
There is broad laughter in the courtroom. Laren has scored again. He sits on the bench, laughing himself.
But, you know, in Mr. Savage's part of town, I would think people say, yeah, you're right. And what they mean is, you are wrong.
Pausing. To be polite. More laughter.
Your Honor, Nico says, isn't that a question for the jury?
On the contrary, Mr. Delay Guardia, that is initially a question for the court. I have to be convinced this evidence is relevant, that it makes the proposition for which it is offered more probable. Now, I am not ruling yet, but, sir, unless you are a good deal more persuasive than you have been so far, I expect that you will find me ruling that this evidence is not relevant. And you might want to keep that in mind in addressing Mr. Stern's motion, because if you're not going to be offering that evidence or relying on it in cross-examination of the defendant, why then, I'd have to deny the defendant's motion.
Laren smiles. Nico, of course, is screwed. The judge has as much as told him that the statement will not be admitted. Nico's choice is to lose Molto and make a futile effort to introduce the evidence, or to keep Tommy and abandon the proof. It is really no choice at all for him. Better to take half a loaf. My statement to Molto has just disappeared from this case. Molto approaches the podium.
Judge,
he says, and gets no further. Laren interrupts. His face drains of all good humor.
Now, Mr. Molto, I will not listen to you address the admissibility of your own testimony. Maybe you can convince me that that time-honored rule prohibiting a lawyer from being a witness in a case he tries shouldn't be applied here, but until you do, I will not hear further from you, sir.
Laren closes business quickly. He says he will see us for trial on August 18th. With one more glance toward the reporters, he leaves the bench. Molto is still standing there, his look of disgruntlement plain. Tommy's always had a bad habit for a trial lawyer of allowing his dissatisfaction to be evident. But Judge Little and he have been going at each other now for many years. I may not have recalled Carolyn's service in the North Branch, but I could never have forgotten Laren and Molto. Their disputes were notorious. Exiled by Bolkara to that judicial Siberia, Judge Little applied his own rough justice. The cops were guilty of harassment, unless proven otherwise. Molto, beleaguered and bitterly unhappy, used to claim that the pimps and junkies and sneak thieves, some of whom made daily appearances in Laren's courtroom, would rise to applaud him when he assumed the bench for the morning call. The police despised Judge Little. They invented racial epithets that showed the same imagination which put humankind upon the moon. Laren had been downtown for years by the time I finished the Night Saints investigation, and Lionel Keneally was still complaining whenever he heard Laren's name. There was one story Keneally must have told me 10 times about a battery case brought by a cop who claimed that the defendant had resisted arrest. The cop, named Manos, said he and the defendant had gotten into a tussle shortly after the defendant called the cop a name.
What name? Laren asked him.
Here in court, said Manos, I'd rather not say, Judge.
Why, officer, are you afraid you might offend those present?
Laren gestured toward the forward benches, where the defendants on the morning call were seated, an assemblage of hookers, pickpockets, and junkie thieves.
Speak freely, Judge Little said.
He called me motherfucker, Your Honor.
From the benches there were whistles, catcalls, lots of joviality. Laren gaveled silence, but he was laughing, too.
"Why, officer," said Laren again, still smiling. "Didn't you know that is a term of endearment in our community?"
The folks on the benches went wild, black power salutes and a frenzy of stroking palms. Manos took all of this in silence. A minute later, when Molto rested, Laren directed a verdict for defense.
"And the great part," Keneally told me, "is that Manos comes up to the bench then, stands there with his hat in his hand, and says to Little, sweet as a school kid, 'Thank you, motherfucker,' before he walks away."
I have heard this story from two other people. They agree on the final exchange, but both of them swear the last remark came from the bench.
Chapter 23.
Every week, usually on Wednesday night, the phone rings. Even before he starts, I know who it is. I can hear him pulling on his goddamn cigarette. I am not supposed to talk to him. He is not supposed to talk to me. We both have our orders. He does not say his name.
"How you doing?"
he asks.
"Hanging in. You guys okay?"
"Getting by.
This is a tough thing."
"Tell me about it." He laughs.
"No, I guess I don't gotta tell you. Well, you need anything? Anything I can do?"
"Not much. You're good to call."
"Yeah, I am, but I figure you'll be running the joint again soon. I'm covering my bets."
"I know you are. What about you? How are you doing?"
"Good. Surviving."
"Schmidt still on your case?" I ask, referring to his boss.
"Hey, always. That's the guy. Screw him, I figure."
"How tough are they making it on you?"
"These cupcakes? Come on."
But I know Lip is having a hard time. Mac, who has also called on a couple of occasions, told me they pulled him back into McGrath Hall, took him off the special command in the PA's office. Schmidt has got him chained to a desk, signing off on other Dick's reports. That is bound to drive him crazy. But Lip always was doing a high-wire act with the department. He had to keep dazzling the crowds to hold off his detractors. Plenty of people were waiting to see him fall. Now he has. Cops will always figure that LaPrans are new and let me hide it. That's just the way they think.
"I'll call next week," he always promises at the end of every conversation.
And he does, faithfully. Our talks do not seem to vary more than a line or two. About a month along, when it was becoming clear to everyone that this was serious, he offered money. "I understand these kind of things can be expensive," he said. "You know, a bohunk's always got some dough salted away." I told him Barbara had come through in the pinch. He made a remark about marrying a Jewish girl. This week, when the phone rings, I have been waiting.
"How you doing?"
he asks. "Hanging in," I say. Barbara picks it up just in time to hear that exchange. "It's for me, Barb," I say. Unaware of our arrangement, she says simply, "Hi, Lip," and puts the phone back down.
"So, what's going on?"
"We're going to trial now," I say. "3 weeks. Less."
"Yeah, I know. I seen the papers."
We both hang on that for a while. There is nothing Dan LaPranzer can do about his testimony. It is going to break my back, both of us know it, and there is no choice. He answered Molto's question the day after the election, before Lip could guess the score, and I tend to think that the answers would have been the same, even if Lip knew the consequences. What happened, happened. That's the way he would explain it to himself.
"So, you getting ready?"
he asks. "We're working real hard. Stern's amazing, he really is. He's the best by a time and a half."
"That's what they say."
When he pauses, I recognize the click of his lighter.
"Well, okay. Anything you need?"
"There is," I say. If he hadn't asked, I wasn't going to say anything. That's the deal I made with myself.
"Shoot,"
he tells me. "I've got to find this guy Leon. Leon Wells. You know, the guy who's supposed to have paid off the PA in the North Branch? The defendant in the court file you dug up, the one with Carolyn and Molto. Stern hired some skip tracer, and he came back with a complete zip. As far as he can tell, no such guy even exists. I don't know any other way to go. I can't have a heart-to-heart with Tommy Molto." This private investigator was named Ned Berman. Sandy said he was good, but he seemed to have no idea what he was doing. I gave him copies of the pages of the court file. 3 days later, he was back saying it could not help. The North Branch man, in those days, he said, it was a real zoo. I wish you luck, I really do. You couldn't tell out there who was doing what to who. Lapranzer takes some time with this request, more than I expected. But I know the problem. If the department finds out he helped in the preparation of my defense, they will can him. Insubordination, disloyalty. 15 years plus and his pension in the dumper. I wouldn't ask, you know I wouldn't, but I think it might really matter. How? He asks. You thinking Tommy's kinky on this? Set you up to keep you from looking? I can tell that even though he is trying not to make judgments, Lapranzer regards that notion as far-fetched. I don't know what to say. You want to hear me say I think it's possible? I do. And whether he's sandbagging me or not, if we could get that kind of stuff out, it would look real bad for him. Something like that can really catch a jury's attention. He is silent again. After I testify, he says. You know, those guys have got their eye on me, and I don't want anybody asking me questions where I gotta give the wrong answer under oath. A lot of people would like to see that. When I get off the stand, they'll ease up. I'll work on it then. Hard. Okay? It is not okay. It is likely to be too late. But I've asked for too much already. That's great. You're a pal. I mean that. I figure you'll be running the joint again soon, he says. He says, I'm just covering my bets. T-ball again. The summer league. In this circuit, mercifully, there are no standings, for the stingers are only marginally improved. In the heavy air of the August evenings, the fly balls still seem to mystify our players. They fall with the unhindered downward velocity of rain. The girls respond better to tutoring. They throw and bat with increasing skill. But the boys seem, for the most part, unreachable. There is no telling them about the merit of a measured swing. Each 8-year-old male comes to the plate with dreams of violent magic in his bat. He envisions home runs and wicked liners. For the boys, there is no point in the repetitive instructions to keep the ball on the ground. Nat, surprisingly, is something of an exception. This summer he is changing, beginning to acquire some worldly focus. He seems newly aware of his powers, and of the fact that people regard the manner in which you do things as a sign of character. When he takes his turn at bat and hits, I watch the way his eyes lift as he comes around first base before he sprints for second. It is not enough to say that he is merely imitating the players on TV, because what is significant is that he noticed in the first place. He's starting to care about style. Barbara says he seems more particular about his clothes. I would be more delighted by all of this were I not wary about the motives for this sudden maturation. He has not reached and developed so much as he has been plucked by the heels from his dreaminess. Nathaniel has turned his attention to the world, I suspect, because he knows that it has caused so much trouble for his father. After the game, we head home alone. No one has been so heartless as to suggest we skip the picnic, but it is for the best. We attended once, after the indictment, and the time passed so fitfully, with such sudden, ponderous silences arising at the mention of the most ordinary topics, work to which I do not go, TV detective shows that turn on predicaments like mine, that I knew we could not return. These men are generous enough to accept my presence among themselves. The risk, I pose, is for the kids. We all must think about the months ahead, the impossibility there would be of explaining where I'd gone and what I did. It is unfair to hobble these splendid evenings with the omen of evil. Instead, Nat and I depart with a friendly wave. I carry the bat, the glove. He goes along, stomping out dandelions. From Nathaniel, there are no words of complaint. I am pathetically touched by this, by my son's loyalty. God only knows what mayhem his friends are wreaking on him. No grown-up can fully imagine the smirking wisecracks, the casual viciousness he bears. And yet he refuses to desert me, the vessel from which this pain has poured. He does not dote, but he is with me. He pulls me to my feet from the sofa to work with him on the slider. He accompanies me at night when I venture out to get the paper and a gallon of milk. He walks beside me through the small woods between our subdivision and the nearing village green. He shows no fear. "Are you scared?" I ask suddenly tonight as we are walking. "You mean scared you won't get off?" The trial looms so near, so large, that even my 8-year-old knows at once what I must mean. "Yes."
"Nah."
"Why not?"
"I'm not, that's all. It's just a bunch of junk, right?"
He squints up at me, from beneath the bill of his cockeyed baseball cap. "In a manner of speaking.
They'll have this trial, and you'll tell what really happened, and that'll be the end of it. That's what Mom says."
Oh, bursting, bursting heart. That's what his mom says. I put my arm around my son, more amazed than ever by his faith in her. I cannot imagine the lengthy therapeutic sessions between mother and child in which she has pitched him up to this level of support. It is a miracle which Barbara alone could have achieved. As a family, we are bound together by this symmetry. In the world, I love Nat most, and he adores his mother. Even at this scrappy age, full of the furious energy of a person of 8, he softens for her as no one else. She alone is allowed to hold him at length, and they enjoy a special sympathy, communion, a dependence that goes deeper even than the unsounded depths of mother and child. He is more like her than me, high-strung and full of her driving intelligence, those dark and private moods. She equals his devotion. He is never out of her imagination. I believe her when she says she could never wrest from herself the same emotion for another child. Neither of them parts from the other comfortably. Last summer, Barbara spent 4 days in Detroit, visiting a college friend, Yetta Graver, who she discovered is now a professor of mathematics. Barbara called twice a day, and Nat was like a running sore, crabby, miserable. The only way I could quiet him for bed was by imagining for him precisely what his mother and Yetta were doing at that moment. "They are in a quiet restaurant," I would tell him. "Each of them is eating fish. It is broiled with very little butter. They each have had a glass of wine. At dessert, they will break down and eat something they find too tempting."
"Pie?"
asked Nat. "Pie," I said. My son, the one I always dreamed of, fell asleep thinking of his mother eating sweets. Chapter 24. "Hi," Marty Pohima says.
"Hi," I answer.
As I came off the landing and caught my first glimpse of the figure and the long hair, I thought it was Kemp, who I am supposed to meet here. Instead, I find this boy, who I have not even thought about for months. We stand alone in the hallway outside Carolyn's apartment, looking at one another. Marty extends his hand and shakes mine firmly. He has no obvious reluctance, almost as if he is pleased to see me. "I didn't expect to see you," I finally say, casting about for some way to ask why he is here. From his shirt pocket, he pulls a copy of Judge Little's order, allowing us to inspect the premises.
"I got this," says Marty.
"Oh, I get it now," I say out loud. "That was only a formality. The judge ordered us to notify the lawyer for the estate, a former PA named Jack Buckley. Jack apparently sent the notice on to the boy. The idea was just to let you object if you mind us going in and looking at some of Carolyn's things. You didn't have to be here."
"Well, that's okay."
This boy sort of shucks and bows as he talks, back and forth. He shows no sign of leaving. I try to make conversation, ask what he is up to. "Last time we talked, you were planning to flunk out and go back home."
"I did," he says, without ceremony. "Actually, I got, like, suspended. I flunked physics. And I made a D in English. I was pretty sure I was going to flunk that, too. I went home 6 weeks ago. I just drove back here yesterday to get together all my junk."
I apologize, and explained that from his presence I had assumed that things had worked out.
"Well, they did work out. I mean, so far as I'm concerned, How'd your father take it?
He shrugs.
He wasn't real happy, about the D especially.
That, like, hurt his feelings.
But he said I had a tough year. I'll work for a while and go back.
Marty looks around at nothing in particular.
So, anyway, when I got that thing, I thought I'd like to come by and see what it was all about.
The psychologists have a term, inappropriate. That is this kid, just sort of shooting the breeze outside the apartment where his mother was killed with the guy who everybody thinks did it. For a second, I wonder if he even knows what's going on. But the caption was right on the notice, People versus Savage. And he could not have missed the build-up to the indictment in the papers. He's not been gone that long. I do not get a chance to probe further because Kemp comes along then. I can hear him on the stairs. He is arguing, and when he turns the corner off the landing, I see with whom. Tom Glendenning, a big cop I never much liked. Glendenning is a white man's white man. Lots of ethnic and racial cracks. Not kidding around, either. His whole sensibility revolves around the fact that he was born white and is now a cop. He treats everybody else like they're intruders. No doubt he'll be just as happy to view me that way. The more there are, the better Tom feels. Kemp is explaining that Glendenning may not enter while we view the apartment, and Glendenning is saying that's not what he understands from Molto. Finally, they agree that Glendenning will go downstairs and use the phone. While he's gone, I introduce Kemp to Marty Polhemus.
You're right, Glendenning says when he comes back. That judge entered such an order.
The way he says that, you know what he's thinking.
Kemp rolls his eyes. He is a good lawyer, but still awfully Ivy League. He will not hesitate to let people know when he regards them as fools. A large phosphorescent orange notice with an adhesive backing has been applied to the door of Carolyn's apartment. It states that this is a crime scene, sealed by order of the Superior Court of Kendall County, and that entry is forbidden. The notice overlaps the threshold, so the door cannot be opened. The locks have been filled with plastic blocks. Glendenning cuts the notice with a razor, but it takes him some time to clear the locks. When he finishes, he produces Carolyn's key ring from his pocket. It has a large red and white evidence tag on it. There is a door handle lock and a deadbolt. As I told Lapranzer a long time ago, Carolyn did not fool around. With the keys in the lower lock, Glendenning turns and without a word frisks Kemp and me, then Marty. This will prevent us from planting anything. I show him a pad of paper I have in my hand. He asks for our wallets. Kemp starts to object, but I motion him to be quiet. Again, without a word, Glendenning does the same to Marty, who already has his wallet in his hand.
Jeez, says Marty. Look at all this stuff. What am I ever going to do with it?
He just wanders in ahead of Kemp and me. I pass a look with Jamie. Neither of us knows if we have the authority to keep him out, or if there is any reason to bother. Glendenning calls in after him.
Hey there, don't touch anything, nothing. Just them can touch, all right?
Marty seems to nod. He drifts through the living room toward the windows, apparently to check the view. The air in here is stale and heavy, used up and burned out by the summer heat. Something somewhere in here may be rotting. There is a faint smell. Although the temperature outside is moderate today, the apartment with the windows sealed never cooled after last week's intense heat. It must be close to 85 degrees. I never believed in ghosts, but it is unsettling to be back. I feel a little curl of strange sensation working its way down from the bottom of my spine. The apartment seems oddly settled, especially since everything has been left largely as it was found. The table and mauve seating piece are still overturned. On the light oak floor, just off the kitchen, an outline of Carolyn's body has been chalked. But everything else seems to have acquired some added density. Beside the sofa, on another glass table, a little inlaid box remains, which I had purchased for Carolyn. She had admired it at Morton's the day I walked over there with her during the McGaffin trial. One of the red dragons on her Chinese screen assesses me with its fiery eye. God, I think. God, did I ever get myself in trouble. Kemp motions to me. He is going to start looking about. He hands me a pair of plastic gloves, loose ones, like baggies with fingers. There's no real need for this, but Stern insisted. Better not to be fighting about fingerprints Tommy Molto claims they discovered long before. I stop a minute by the bar. It's on the wall directly by the kitchen. I thought I could see what I'm looking for from the police photographs of the scene, but I want to be certain. I stand 3 feet from the glassware and count the tumblers lined up on a towel. It is on one of the glasses of this set that my prints have been identified. There are 12 of them here. I count them twice to be sure. Jamie comes beside me. He whispers, "Where in the hell do we look?" He wants to see whether there are accessories on hand used by Carolyn for birth control. "There's a John over that way," I say quietly. "Medicine cabinet and vanity." I tell him I will check the bedroom. I look first inside her closet. Her smell is on everything. I recognize the clothes I saw her wear. These sights stir mild sensation, buffeting against something that wants this all suppressed. I don't know if it is an impulse to be clinical or the sense, which I always previously seemed to check at the door here, of what is properly forbidden. I move on to her drawers. Her bedside table, a chubby-looking piece with clubbed Queen Anne feet, holds the telephone. This is as likely a spot as any, but when I open the single drawer, I see nothing but her pantyhose. I push them around and find a phone directory, a skinny volume covered in light brown calf's leather. The coppers always miss something. I can't resist. I check under S. Nothing. Then I think of R. Yes. At least I made the book. My work and home numbers are listed. I graze a minute. Horgan is here. Molto is not listed by name, but there is somebody called T.M., which is probably him. I realize I should see about her doctors. D is it. I write the names down and put the paper in my pocket. Outside, I hear a stirring. For some reason, my first thought is that it is Glendenning, who has decided to ignore the dark-skinned judge and snoop. I flip the pages on the book to protect what I have found, but when the figure passes by the door, it is only Marty, wandering. He looks in and waves. The page I turn is L. Laren, it says, right at the top. There are 3 numbers listed. Well, I think. That must have been a cozy group out of the North Branch. Everybody's here. Then I think again. Not quite. I check N and D, even G. Nico never made it. I tuck the book back under the pantyhose. Marty is lurking at the bedroom door. Pretty strange, huh? That it is. I nod sadly. He tells me that he is going to wait outside. I try to let him know that he is free to leave, but the kid is dense and doesn't get the hint. When I find Kemp, he is going through the living room. There's nothing here, he tells me. No foam, no cream. I don't even find a case for a diaphragm. Am I missing something? Do women hide that stuff? Not that I know of. Barbara keeps hers in the top drawer of the dresser. I wouldn't have any ideas about anyone else. Well, if the chemist says contraceptive cream is present and it's not seized from the apartment, Kemp says, you tell me where it's at. I guess I took it, I said, when I grabbed the diaphragm. With both Kemp and Stern, I have fallen into this habit, speculating in the first person on what Nico will say I did. Jamie especially finds it amusing. Why would you do that? I consider for a moment. Maybe it would hide the fact that I took the diaphragm. But that doesn't make sense. It's supposed to be rape. What difference does it make what the hell she did when she wanted to have sex? I guess I wasn't thinking clearly. If I had been, I wouldn't have left the glass on the bar. Kemp smiles. He likes the byplay, fast words. This helps, he says. There's no way around it. I want to get hold of Berman, he says, referring to the PI. He should search himself, so he can testify about it. He'll be available in about an hour. Wait until Glendenning hears he has to wait. He'll blow a gut. The four of us meet outside the apartment and watch Glendenning lock the door. He pats each one of us down again. Glendenning, as Kemp predicted, refuses to wait for Berman. Kemp tells him that he has to. The court order gives us access for the day. I don't take orders from any rock and roll defense lawyer, says Glendenning. Even when I was on his side, I thought this guy was all charm. Well, let's go see the judge then, Kemp says. Jamie got Glendenning's number quick. The copper looks to the ceiling like this is the most ridiculous thing he's ever heard. But by now, he's trapped. He and Kemp pound down the stairway, exchanging words. I am left with Marty Polhemus. Nice guy, huh? I asked Marty. He asks me in all seriousness, which one? I was talking about the policeman. He seemed all right. He said that, what's his name, Mr. Kemp, used to be in the Galactics. When I confirm that, the boy predictably says, wow. Then he goes silent. He still seems to be waiting for something. I talked to them, you know, the cops.
Did you?
I am thinking about the glassware by the bar. They asked me about you, you know, about when you came out to see me.
Well, that's their job.
Yeah, they wanted to know if you, like, said anything about your relationship with her. I mean, with Carolyn, you know? I have to exert control to avoid a reflex to pivot. I had forgotten that I told this goddamn kid. That is Nico's evidence. That is how he's going to prove up the affair. A thick, bilious feeling cuts deep in my throat. They asked me a couple of times, you know. I said, I mean, I thought we had a real talk, you know?
Sure, I say.
And I told them that you didn't say anything about that.
I look at the boy.
Okay? He asks. I am, of course, supposed to remind him to tell the truth.
Sure, I say again.
I don't think you're the guy who killed her.
I appreciate that.
It's like karma, he says. It isn't right. I smile. I lift my hand to direct him to the landing, and just like that, it hits me. It's like running into a wall, the recognition and the panic. I am so frightened that my legs begin to give out, actually buckle, and I reach for the railing.
You fool, I think. You fool! He's wired. He is wearing a tape recorder. Nico and Molto wired him up. That is what he is doing here. That's why he does not seem right.
He isn't. He follows us into the apartment and watches everything we do and gets me out here to suborn him. And I've just convicted myself. I'm gone. I feel that I'm going to faint. I falter again, but this time I turn backward. Marty extends his hand.
What is it?
When I look at him, I know I'm crazy, absurd. He is dressed for the season, a tight T-shirt and shorts, not even a belt. Nobody can hide equipment under that. I watched Glendenning frisk him, and it's not there in his eyes, either. All I see is this spaced-out kid, kindly, timid, terribly lost. I have suddenly sweated through my shirt. I am wrung out now, and weak. My pulse is beating far up in my arms. I'm okay, I tell him. But Marty takes my elbow anyway as we start down the stairs. It's the place, I say. It does bad things to me. Chapter 25. 3 a.m. When I awake, my heart is racing and cool traces of sweat are abrading my neck, so that in the idiocy of sleep I am trying to loosen my collar. I grope, then lie back. My breath is short, and my heartbeat thunders intermittently in the ear against the pillow. My dream is still clear to me. My mother's face in agony. That worn, cadaverous image as she neared the end, and worse, her look of lost, unspeaking terror. When my mother became sick and quickly died, she was in the most peaceful period of her adult life. She and my father were no longer living together, although they still worked side by side each day in the bakery. He had moved in with a widow, Mrs. Bova, whose urgent bearing when she came into the shop I can remember even from the years before her husband died. For my mother, whose life with my father had been a dominion of fear, this arrangement became a kind of liberation. Her interest in the world outside her suddenly increased. She became one of the first of the regular callers on those listener participation talk shows. Tell us what you think about interracial dating, legalizing marijuana, who killed Kennedy. She stacked the dining room table with old newspapers and magazines, pads and index cards on which she made notations to herself, preparing for tomorrow's programs. My mother, who was phobic about venturing beyond our apartment building or the shop, who had to begin her preparations early in the morning if she was going to depart her home sometime that afternoon, who from the time I was 8 sent me to the market so that she could avoid leaving the house, my mother became a local personality of sorts for her outspoken views about various worldly controversies. I could not reconcile this development with the accommodations I had made long before with myself to accept her wildly verging eccentricities or the narrow margins of her former life. She had been 28, 4 years my father's senior, when they were married, the 6th daughter of a Jewish union organizer and a lass from Cork. My father wed, I'm sure, for her savings, which allowed him to open up the shop.